Hi, I'm Malcolm Nichols.
And I'm Richard Ayling.
And this is Man Reimagined, a podcast where we, as men, attempt to reimagine ourselves in the 21st century.
How can we respond to the big questions that we're facing, both within ourselves and within society, and make sense of this ever-changing world?
We don't have all the answers, but we do want to create a conversation. So join us moving forward as a man reimagined. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Man Reimagined. This week, this episode is going to be a little bit different from everything else we've done in the past. Normally, it's Rich and myself sitting here and either talking to each other or inviting guests in to grill them about who they are and what they are and sharing their gold for the rest of the world. Tonight, however, because it is night time as I record this, I'm holding the mic all on my own. And the reason for that is that tonight I'm going to share quite a personal story that has been taking place for me over the last couple of years. And that's been the journey of supporting my wife through her cancer. Originally, when Rich and I talked about doing this episode, you know, we were going to do it as normal. He was probably most likely going to ask me questions, and I was just going to talk and reflect on everything that's gone on. And then as we were planning this episode, it came quite apparent that actually, you know, this is my tale, this is my journey, and that actually it felt right for me just to take the mic on my own and go through the journey and the story of the last 2 years, and with the intention of sharing a story, sharing an experience. I mean, it's an experience that a lot of people have gone through, but it's also an experience that is quite unique for each person who goes through it as well. So, you know, I wanted to share what it is like to be a man, to be a husband, to be a father, as his wife goes through the very intense journey of leukemia, diagnosis, treatment, outcome, relapse, transplant, etc. It's been a massive journey. So, partly I wanted to share the journey, partly I wanted to share some of the stuff I've learned, but as much as anything, I just wanted to. Part of what we're doing here on Man Reimagined is it's about creating conversations. And this is a hell of a conversation, really. It's the conversation of the ups and downs. And, you know, there are lots of both, but I'll be brutally honest and say there's a lot more downs than there is ups of being in this journey around cancer. And in particular, being in the journey of support in cancer. It's obviously very different than having the cancer itself, but there's a lot of it's by no means pain free. There's a lot of pain, there's a lot of hardship, and there's a lot of challenges that go with being a support person. So I'm going to talk a lot to that tonight and as we go through it. But before we get in there, what I'm going to start with is just simply talking through the journey itself, starting with where we are right now, and then I'm going to bounce back into the beginning and just to come all the way through. So my wife, Evie, is about 12 days post bone marrow transplant. It's actually a stem cell transplant. It used to be called a bone marrow transplant when in the old days, they would actually use bone marrow from a donor to give to the person with the recipient, the person with cancer. Now it's all stem cells, and I'll talk to that later. But so Evie had her stem cell transplant 12 days ago, and that was because she, August of 2020, she was diagnosed with leukemia, and one of the one of the treatments for leukemia is a transplant. That's if either the initial treatment doesn't work, or the type of leukemia, or any other blood cancers, lymphoma, etc. If they're too severe, or you know, there's different variations of these cancers that they understand now, and some are more easily treatable than others. And the ones that are harder to treat, the transplant is the option that a lot of people go down, particularly younger people. It's not so practical for older people because it's so intense. And you know, I'm witnessing that right now, 12 days into this, and it's intense for Evie. I mean, we've been through a lot in the last 2 years, and this is the worst I've seen it, and the worst I've seen her, or the hardest hit. It's huge what she's going through right now. At the moment, she can't eat. She's having to be fed intravenously. She hasn't eaten probably for 3 days. Can't take water, nil by mouth, as they say. She can't take water. She can't swallow. She can't speak. She can't, and that's because the chemo that needed to happen for the bone marrow transplant to occur has just completely wiped out her immune system, which has then in turn destroyed all of her mucal linings in her stomach, esophagus, etc. So she just can't take anything in, and she's got internal bleeding and, you know, lots of nausea and throat. I mean, it's just fucking horrendous. And so she's right in the depths of that at the moment, and probably will be there for another few days before her immune system starts to climb up and get her out of that, so that she can then begin to heal. So I mean, even though what I've said sounds pretty horrific, she is on the path, like it is actually on the path to healing. And you might be wondering, you know, why am I doing this, talking about this podcast right now, when, you know, she's still kind of in the early stages, if you like, of recovering after the stem cell transplant. I mean, she's got a good 3 to 4 months of very serious recovery, which will mean, you know, for the next another two or three weeks, she's probably going to be in the hospital. And then from there, she's going to move into residential living just off the hospital. So, you know, she's only really in the early stages, but I wanted to share this story because right now, because it's a living story, you know, and I'm living in the middle of it. And how I'm feeling right now is, you know, I'm deeply, deeply centered in the eye of the storm with Evie. And I know that will change, you know, 2-3 months from now, as she's recovering, as she's getting better, and a lot of the emotion begins to fall out of all of this situation, you know, then it'll be different. So I just felt really drawn to speak now to how it feels and what's been going on. And then, you know, maybe in a few months' time we can revisit this, Rich, and I can actually come back and look at it. So that's why I'm here. That's why we're here. And I mean, another reason why I'm drawn to share this is that it is such, because as I said earlier, you know, a lot of people do go through this, but there is a lot of mystery to it. I mean, I had no idea before I got into all of this with Evie. I just had no idea what it was like to go through cancer, to support somebody, to experience it. And, you know, I had a lot of misconceptions, to be perfectly honest. I had thoughts, ideas, expectations of what it might be like. And actually it's completely fucking different. So, you know, here I am, I'm going to share this story as it goes. And you know, I really hope that as you listen to this, you get something out of it. This is a topic now that I'm really keen to talk more of. I share a lot online with my, writing on Facebook, etc. Just share the journey as it happens, my journey, what I'm witnessing in Evie, and also as a dad. You know, this is all really relevant stuff. So so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to jump back to the start, to what happened, because it's still as fresh now 2 years on as it was when it first happened. So when all this first happened, we were living in Bali. So Evie and I and Maya had been in Bali for a number of years, and it was home. It was, you know, certainly for me, it was a bit, I felt more at home there than I can remember really feeling anywhere, actually. I was loving it, loving my life. And it was about July of 2020. So COVID had hit, and, you know, the world was pretty shut down at that stage. Bali's borders were actually closed. Nobody could get in or out. Oh, no, Bali's borders had been closed through June. Nobody could get in or out. And then they started to open up a little bit, but there was no foreign tourism and just a little bit of local tourism. But essentially, yeah, it was the island was very, very quiet, and it was awesome, actually. It was so lovely and hard for the Balinese, but, you know, great from the perspective of it was just slow and probably how it used to be. I don't know, but so it was would have been beginning of July, and Evie started to get these really, really strong pains in her joints and in her bones and her legs. And so we went to the doctor to get some tests done, and the test came back and said that she had rheumatic fever, which in the Western world is something only kids ever really get. It's quite rare for an adult to get it. But in a place like Bali, it's not that unusual. It doesn't happen all the time. It's not that unusual. So she received treatment for the rheumatic fever for a couple of weeks, and it got a little bit less, but it, you know, it went away a little bit, but it didn't completely go away, the pain, but it definitely subsided. So we just assumed that that's what was going on. And then it was 4 weeks after that diagnosis of rheumatic fever. So right at the very beginning of August, Evie had a period, a hemorrhaging period. And, you know, me being a bloke, I had no idea what that meant or what it was or anything. And I just shook it off and didn't even think about it. But Evie's mum, God bless her, said to her, look, you really need to go and see your GP again and get some more tests. And she did, and got some blood tests. And, you know, there's always a moment, right, when you don't hear the good, no news is good news, right? Not hearing back from the doctor and not hearing anything is kind of ideal. In this instance, the doc called back. So it was a Monday. The doc called back on the Monday evening and said, look, it's really important tomorrow you go to the hospital to go and see a hematologist. The hematologists are doctors that work with blood. And she said, look, it's vitally important that you go in there. You need to go in. And so, you know, still didn't know what was going on. So, you know, we called around and we couldn't actually get any appointments. The earliest we could get was Thursday. And so we spoke again to our GP, and she's like, no, look, I'm going to call the hospital and get an appointment for you. You know, you go to the hospital at 8 o'clock in the morning and show up there, and I'll organize it for you. And she said, I'll send you the referral note so you've got it. And at this point, we didn't know what was going on. So the doctor sent us the referral, or sent via text, Evie, the referral note. And on the bottom of the referral note, it said, suspected acute leukemia. So at this point, I mean, I don't know. There's a story that I've remembered hearing, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but it's a story I remember hearing of Native Americans when, in the onshore being, you know, going about their life when European, and this is a story of when the Europeans arrived. And apparently, as the story goes, a European ship pulled up into a harbor, and the Native Americans were on shore as they were going about their life. And these Europeans got off into a boat, and they rowed their boat, or what is it? Yeah, rowed their boat all the way into shore. And the Native Americans didn't actually see the Europeans until they stepped off their boat onto the shore. It was as if, because the idea of the Europeans being there was so far out of their frame of reference, it's like they couldn't even pick it up. They couldn't even see it. And this is, I'm telling this story because this is exactly what happened to me with this note, with this written note. Evie brings it, when she got the note, she walks up to me and she's like, "Have a look at this." And she put it in front of me and I had a look at it. It just looked like a standard referral, right? I'm looking at it. And she then pointed at these words, acute leukemia, that were sitting right in front of me, and I hadn't even seen them. It was like the paper was blank, and then all of a sudden these words popped out. And I'll never, ever forget that feeling of just being absolutely floored. I mean, for one, you know, I'd heard of leukemia, but I didn't even really know what the fuck it was, to be perfectly honest. It's like, what? I mean, I had a vague idea it was a blood cancer, but that was about it. And here we are being told that she's got acute leukemia. So, you know, we're instantly off to the hospital, and eventually admitted that day. And of course, you know, this is a private hospital, and so one of the unfortunate situations that had happened to us was, because of COVID, you know, we'd been there and had insurance for the 4 years we were there, but with COVID hitting, we needed to renew our insurance. But all of a sudden, it was, you know, it was up to $6,000 for the three of us. And at that time, we just didn't have it. We were unsure of quite what was going on from a work perspective. So we'd actually let our insurance lapse. So, you know, just to make things a little bit worse. But she got admitted into this hospital where they did a whole bunch of tests and essentially confirmed that, yes, it was leukemia. She had blood transfusions and things like that. So, you know, at this moment, I'm completely freaking out. You know, that the emotion that I think I experienced over the course of those 2 or 3 days was the most extreme that I think I can remember ever feeling. It was just an emotional storm, really, of tears, anxiety, completely unsure of where what any of this meant. You know, it was literally that feeling of the ground being completely pulled out from underneath, and feeling so shaky. And of course, Evie was too, right? We just, neither of us really knew what it meant. But it also, it was really hard to get a sense of where we were, what it meant over there. Because, I mean, the doctors in Bali essentially said, look, this is a diagnosis. You need to go home and get treatment there. They were pretty flat out honest. They said, you're not going to get the treatment you need here. So I'm, you know, on the phone trying to get back into New Zealand to find out what's going on. And the big thing I find is that I get from them is that they're all freaking out as well, because if we're in New Zealand, they would be saying, look, Evie would be on chemotherapy getting treatment tonight. With that diagnosis, that would be happening tonight. She would be admitted today. And we're in Bali in COVID in a situation where there's no flights. We've got no insurance, so we can't get treatment in Bali. And even if we could, they've recommended that we don't. And being told that we need to start getting treatment immediately. It was the biggest head fuck ever. And at this point, I was getting, I got very angry with COVID and everything that it brought. But, you know, we were faced with this situation. And in the end, what happened was we did manage to get flight. It took us about, I think it was about 12 days from the time of diagnosis to the time we were able to get flights to go out. So it meant that we had, you know, 12 days in Bali, which in some ways ended up being quite good because it gave Evie a time to explore her own level of healing. Because one of the, so when I say explore our own level of healing, explore, what I really mean is explore alternative parts of healing and also to do some inner healing for herself, you know, because the one thing that obviously when somebody gets a diagnosis of leukemia and they're then rushed into hospital that day, there's just no time to do any kind of reflection on where it's at and what's going on. And you know, for me and for Evie, we've both, like, I'm a healer, you know, that's what my background is, that's where I come from. I've spent 20 years as a body worker, and you know, I've always had this question, you know, about self-healing and in particular cancer, and you know, what, you know, is chemotherapy really necessary, because it's so intense, you know, we can heal ourselves, so many people heal ourselves, is the capacity for self-healing is huge, right? These are all my beliefs, and I know that they were Evie's too. So, you know, one thing about having this time is that it actually gave us time to, or gave Evie time to explore some healing, some self-healing for herself. And there was always a question mark for her at the beginning. The question mark was, you know, do I actually want to do chemotherapy? And this is a big part of this discussion that I'm, or this story that I want to talk to, is this piece around, you know, for her, it was like, do I want to do chemotherapy? If I, in her mind, it's like, if I believe in the capacity of healing and self-healing, shouldn't I be able to do this now myself? And that was a very, you know, that was a very real question. And in fact, it was such a big question that we were booked to fly out on I think it was a Wednesday, and Evie asked to delay the plane to move to a flight 3 days later so that she could explore her healing. And you have to understand that trying to delay a ticket in a time when it was almost nigh on impossible to get a ticket is a big ask, right? But she needed to do it, and she needed to explore whether she wanted to go down this path of self-healing. And she did some amazing stuff. And what I will say about this, because it's such a huge topic to get into, but what I will say is that leukemia is such a fast-acting cancer. Acute myeloid leukemia is what Evie has. And I mean, literally, there's a reason why doctors say you need to come in today so we can start your treatment tonight when they find out, is because, you know, when you discover you have leukemia, sometimes you've only got weeks. You know, it goes so quick. This is with the acute leukemia. It proliferates so quickly, and in a very short space of time, your entire bloodstream and white cells are inundated with cancerous cells. So essentially with leukemia, what happens is that it's in the white blood cells, and there's a malfunction in the chromosome. And now, as science is becoming more and more advanced, what they're understanding is that there are different types of chromosomal malfunctions that determine the type of leukemia. And you know, this is all developing like right now as we speak. You know, it's all it's changing so dramatically from how it was, you know, 5-10 years ago. It's very, very different. So, you know, they're able to understand that there are these chromosomal malfunctions. And so in what it's doing is that these malfunctioning white blood cells are essentially, manufactured in the bone marrow. So the bone marrow is where our blood is made. It's made in the bone marrow, and then it gets released out into the bloodstream where it goes around and does its job. And that's the red blood cells, the white blood cells, and then the platelets. Now, with leukemia, the white blood cells are the ones that are malfunctioning. And white blood cells take care of our immunity. They heal, right? They go around and clean everything up. And in leukemia, though, when these white blood cells have been made in the bone marrow, what's happening is they're getting released into the bloodstream prematurely. So they're not getting to maturity where they're functioning properly. So they're getting released into the bloodstream. And essentially what happens is the blood gets overwhelmed by these immature blood cells, and which means that the person is unable to fight off infection, and they end up dying, basically dying of some kind of infection. Their immune system drops and they can't fight it out, and they die of some infection, whether it's some kind of pneumonia or some kind of infection. But that all happens very, very rapidly. And you know, so one of the things is with leukemia, we didn't know any of this at the first time. We didn't know any of this at all. And so what that means from, but what it means from a, you know, self-healing perspective is that there's so little, you know, there's almost no time to make a decision. It means that you've either got to choose one way or the other, and whichever way you choose, that's kind of the bed you've made, and you've got to go and sleep in it, right? So there's not much going back if you make the wrong decision. And which is very different to other types of cancers, which can be quite slow. You know, some of them are slow burn. Bowel cancer can be hovering, can take years. So can some of the others. So can some tumors. Some tumors can go really rapidly, but, you know, different things. So, you know, some cancers allow for time to explore different types of healing if that's appropriate, but this one, definitely not. And it was that rapid nature of it, which, you know, after a period of reflection and discussion, and for Evie, it was very much a self-reflection. It was really obvious that it was too risky to go down the path of natural healing, if you like, to go down the path of alternative medicine. And here's what I'm going to say about that, because it's quite a big, you know, particularly with as a consequence of COVID right now, with the world and this, you know, the polarization between people who trust vaccines and people who don't, people who trust Western medicine and people who don't, if you like. What I've come to see over the course of the last 2 years with Evie and her journey is that Western medicine is remarkable at healing and working with very difficult diseases. I mean, essentially things that are going to kill us. I mean, the way I look at it is we've got a health spectrum, right? And if you think of it, it's like a timeline. On one end, you've got optimal health, which is kind of the ideal, right? Where everything's functioning smoothly and beautifully. And then all the way down the other end, you've got death. And then somewhere in the middle is there's a tipping point in the middle, which is kind of where we tip over. So if you're looking at it on the left, say on the left hand side, you've got optimal health, and the right hand side, you've got death. in the middle and over towards the left-hand side, you've got this kind of sense of health and wellness, right? Where we're trying to maintain a body that, you know, is vibrant with energy and alive, right? And able to do everything we want to do. And on that side, you know, that's where wellness sits. This is where all this complementary and alternative medicine does remarkably well at keeping us healthy. So much better than Western medicine, in my opinion. However, from the center to the right, towards death, we've got, you know, this is the area of disease. And this is like a tipping point. It's when we tip over from a place where our body is able to kind of naturally heal and repair itself to a place where, you know, our body is really struggling to combat, whether it's an infection or some kind of, like with Evie, some kind of malfunction in its genetic code, whatever it is, right? Some cancer that's sprung up. In this side, in this area of disease, this is where Western medicine, I've come to appreciate, really comes into its own. It's amazing. What it's able to do is breathtaking. I mean, 20, 30 years ago, Evie most likely would not have survived. I mean, maybe 30 years, but, you know, not that long prior to that, Evie probably would not have survived what she has got, what she's going through, you know, and they wouldn't have understood probably quite why she had died. You know, it's remarkable how they're able to treat these conditions. I mean, it's not pretty. Chemotherapy is not pretty, and that's absolutely true. There's no denying that. However, there are new treatments on the way. There are already treatments out there that are nowhere near as harsh as chemo. And the only problem is that they're super expensive. And, you know, and therein lies one of the rubs, right? The arguments around Western medicine and the profit-driven model of people who practice Western medicine, or the pharmaceutical companies, etc. However, my retort to that, of course, is that I'm yet to meet any Westerner who practices alternative medicine who doesn't do it for a profit as well and isn't driven by the motive of making some money. Yes, they're in there for healing, but yes, they're making money. And what I've come to see is people who work in the Western, you know, pharmaceutical monies, that they heal people and they make money. They just do it on a fucking massive, quite gross scale. But, you know, so it is a rub. And I think what I've come to appreciate is that there is a right place and a right time for each therapy. And when it comes to treating cancer, you know, Western medicine, on the whole, as a generalization, I think does as good a job as it possibly could do. I think it does a better job than if we were to leave it to some more traditional and alternative therapies. It's not to say that they don't work, and there's probably stuff out there hidden away in the jungles of Borneo, etc. I've heard of some roots that the locals eat and they use to brew up teas, etc., and nobody gets cancer up there. And I'm sure that those things exist. But for the most of us who with, and yet what we've got access to in this instance, I think Western medicine really works. And the final piece I'm going to say, and the reason I say this now, because the other piece that happens in the world of healing, and this is part of what I think is maybe gone on with this COVID, with the polarization around COVID, right, is that it's like if you're a healer or have this tendency towards this idea that our body can heal itself, which it can, without a doubt, but if there's a tendency to lean towards that, there's almost a guilt. And I know that Evie experienced this in her decision to go towards chemotherapy. There is a guilt. There's almost a sense of failure around not being able to heal herself. And And I think that is really unfair because there are conditions. We need help. We need help, whether it's psychological help or, this medicinal help. You know, we in life we need help, and in some ways, in this kind of alternative medicine world, or sorry, the complementary medicine world, however you want to work at the natural healing world, there's almost this guilt that gets wrapped up in this idea of not being able to do self-healing. And where that links back to is often the last little bit I'm going to say about this is that what I've also come to see is that there is a bit of a lack of accountability within natural healers and the world of this natural healing around things like these big issues around treating cancer, for example. And what I mean by that is, you know, you go and see a Western medicine doctor and it's ruled by science, and they're going to give you the stats of everything that you need to know within. You go to a lot of healers and they're just going to give you hope. You know, yes, hope is a great thing, but they're going to give you stories, anecdotal stories of people who have survived and had miraculous outcomes, you know, but they can always be found, you know. But how accountable is that person, that healer, then going to be if it doesn't go right? If are they going to take responsibility for giving advice, which might have been based on their internal thoughts and beliefs and ideals, but not backed up with any pure, right, real concrete example. So, you know, I'm just sharing this because it's been a big eye-opening experience for me just to really realize the complexity of the choices that people face when they come up against cancer, particularly if you come from this belief system of self-healing. And for me, you know, I've really learned to appreciate just how good Western medicine is when it comes to treating this cancer and for helping Evie. It has saved her life, and it's, and I'm really grateful for that. I'm super, super grateful for that. You know, all the way through. From the moment we got back into New Zealand, so we managed to come back into New Zealand. We eventually got here after Evie did her, you know, we had the delay in Bali, which from an emotional perspective was really good for Evie and for us. It was, it was so important. And, you know, we were actually really grateful for that. I think part of for Evie actually even just saying, look, she wanted to delay her flight by 3 days, you know, it gave her a sense of control that she didn't have felt like she didn't have through any of this process. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for the emotional for making sure that, you know, that there's time for the emotional body to catch up to what's actually going on. So in this instance, it was, you know, Evie giving herself just even a couple of the extra days before she jumped on a plane to go and get treatment just meant that she was able to feel ready for it. And because trust me, you kind of do, I mean, it's impossible to be ready for something like chemotherapy, but you do kind of need to be ready for it. it's a big journey, and I'm saying that from the outside. You know, I mean, when we got back to New Zealand, Evie went. You know, she had to undergo 4 rounds of chemotherapy, which essentially took between 5 to 6 months to go through. So, each round consisted of you know, numerous days of chemotherapy. The first round was 10 days, the second round was 7, and the final two rounds were 3 days. So even though the doses, the days got shorter for the delivery of the chemotherapy in each round, they got more, much more intense, much more high dosage. So, you know, the recovery actually was the same period each time. It would take a four to 5 weeks of recovery post the chemo. But I just want to speak a little bit about the process of what a body goes through chemo, because this is where, as a support person, it gets challenging, it gets hard, because, you know, so what would happen for her is that she'd start the chemo, and, you know, it would go for a period of time. So let's just say she did the first round. She did, it was 10 days of chemo. And that first one needs to be long, because, you know, that's, her body's riddled with the cancer at that point. So they need to try to get rid of as much of it as possible in that first round. So, you know, it's 10 days of chemotherapy. And then, so generally what tends to happen is when she starts the chemo, she still has an immune system, like her, the white blood cells, that there is some form of immune system. They call it neutrophils are the main thing that they look for in this. So she has some kind of immune system, usually somewhere four to 7 days post finishing the chemotherapy, her body bottoms out and it no longer has any more neutrophils, no more immunity left, right? It's empty. And so at that stage, what it then means is that her body is highly susceptible to any kind of infection. And I mean, we're talking like what would often happen is, you know, she would get an ulcer in her mouth, for example, and then an infection, some kind of infection will get into her bloodstream via that ulcer. So, and usually it comes from her own saliva. So essentially at that point, and this happened every single round after, you know, 4 to 7 days after the chemo finished, her immune system would bottom out, her neutrophils would go down to zero, and then at some point she would get an infection, and then she would be admitted back into hospital, at which time they would put her on really high dose antibiotics, essentially keeping her alive, getting rid of the infection and keeping Evie alive until her immune system began to ramp itself up and start to work again. And it's all, I mean, it's amazing. It's instantaneous. The moment her immune system kicked back into gear, the infections that were in her body would be dispelled, would disappear. And also all of these things like the ulcers and, you know, often irritable bowel, stuffed stomach, all these areas where they've got linings which are populated by fast replicating cells. Fast replicating cells are the things that chemotherapy attacks, because that's what cancer is. But also so are these mucal linings in the stomach and the bowel, etc., in the throat. So they get all of those. That's why the hair drops out, because the hair follicles are fast replicating cells, so they all drop out. So you know the moment the immune system starts to kick back in, everything starts to repair itself. It's amazing, and this is one of the mind blowing things that I've got, is just how amazing our immune system is. Because when it's knocked out, literally, you know, Evie wouldn't last for, you know, 3 or 4 days, maybe a week before she got sick. You know, that's how, without an immune system, that's how quickly we would die. Our immune system is absolutely staggering, the way that it works. I've been blown away by it every single time. And I'm also blown away by the fact that, you know, there are these antibiotics that we can use, which act like the immune system, keep all these bugs at bay, the bacteria at bay. It's just incredible, really. Where I was going with as a support person for this, though, is that as a support person watching all of this, sitting with Evie when she's going through these infections is so hard because, you know, it's 40 degree fevers, in and out of them day in, day out for days on end. And, it's heartbreaking because there's nothing I can do. There's nothing that I could do except sit there and be with her. And, you know, and now as she's going through this post-transplant, it's like twice as worse as I've ever seen through any of the experiences that we've had. And it's such a helpless place to be, to see somebody you love and care for in so much pain. And I know that many, many people experience their partners going through it, and or experience their family members, loved ones. I mean, God forbid seeing your child go through it. It's so hard and so heartbreaking and so helpless a place to be. And yeah, I've just learned that, you know, the best thing, the only thing I can do is be there and show up and hold Evie in her pain and hold Evie through the sadness, through the anger, through all of that as it arises, if she has the energy for it. But a lot of times, right now she's going through her trauma from the trauma and recovery from the transplant, you know, there's nothing that she can do other than just simply survive the pain right now. You know, she's often eyes closed, just completely in an inner world. She cannot meet the outside world at the moment because of the pain that she's in. And to support somebody through that is so tough, you know, because I just want to take that away from her, but I can't. And so all I can actually do is be willing to be there with her with that, you know, show up and be there with her, and hold her. And at the moment, massaging her legs, massaging her feet, you know, touching your body just to help it feel a little bit better. And, you know, that really is the one and only gift that I can give her right now. And that's what being a support person actually is all about. Really, it's just simply being willing to show up and hold them in their pain and with their pain. And it is the fucking hardest thing I think I've ever had to do. It's so hard. And what also makes it so hard is that, you know, through all this, you know, I've had my own shit going on. You know, leaving Bali brought a huge amount of grief for me because it's my home. That's the place that, you know, I loved. It's the place that, if I had a choice, I would be there, you know. And so I've got a huge amount of grief of having to leave Bali, and so I've got that going on, you know. There's a lot of insecurity for me personally about, you know, we've moved back to New Zealand, and while, you know, I feel eternally grateful for the fact that all the medical treatment that Evie is getting is free. And, you know, this, I'm going to speak to this bit as well, because, you know, being able to have the access to this, to live in a place where, you know, all of this is covered, as a as a New Zealand citizen, as a person who lives here, to have it covered and to be able to get this kind of retreatment is just mind-blowing. You know, when I consider how many people in the world won't have access to this, and that includes America, you know, the wealthiest country in the world, but I can't imagine there's a lot of people who won't get this kind of treatment that Evie's getting. But, you know, there's also how many billions of people in the world won't get this kind of care. So, you know, I'm so incredibly grateful for that. And yet, you know, in my human nature and being a self, being, you know, as the Buddhists would call it, you know, self, it's not self-indulgent, but, you know, self-focused as a human being, you know, we all are to a degree, you know, that I can't help my grief. I can't help the fact that this is not where I want to be. It's not, you know, and I'm struggling to find a place, you know, because we've had to move three times now. We've moved back from Bali to Auckland post the treatment. When Evie finished her treatment after 6 months and was given the all clear, told that she was in remission, we went and moved to a small town in New Zealand called Raitahi, where we were looking after a ski lodge. And really we were there trying to recover, trying to find our grounding back in New Zealand, giving Evie some time to heal in a small town and at the foot of a mountain. And it was actually bloody, it was perfect and to a greater or lesser degree. The only real downside to it probably was that we didn't actually give Evie enough time to really just completely heal and do nothing. She only really had about 6 to 8 weeks post finishing her treatment before we moved to the small town, and we started taking care of a lodge, which meant that, you know, Evie was doing some work. And, you know, really in hindsight, she should have taken at least 6 months, I reckon, 6 months post finishing all that to just do nothing, to really heal mentally, emotionally, you know, spiritually heal. She didn't get enough time. And but we moved to this lodge and I loved it. I loved the small town. It was actually quite healing for me. It was, although by the end of it, I was, you know, starting to, by the 9 months into it, I was starting to dream again of going to Bali and moving back to Bali. And it was in that process of beginning to dream again, thinking that it might be just around the corner, Evie's relapse happened. And, you know, we found the relapse because one of the amazing things that they do post this kind of cancer is, you know, she was getting every 3 months, she was going to get quite sophisticated tests to check how her bone marrow was. And it was in one of those sophisticated tests that was done in October of last year, 2021. That they found a hint of the cancer coming back. They found some cancer there, which meant they had to had to retest, because it takes about 4 weeks to get the results of these tests. They're so sophisticated now. You know, testing parts per million at a cellular level, it's just bonkers. And then so they did another test and it had shown it was just a little bit more than the previous test, but it was enough for them to say, yep, you've relapsed. And that, so that was November of last year. Well, we got that message that she had relapsed. And in that moment, you know, it's a strange feeling because we knew it was always there as a possibility, but if I'm brutally honest, it was almost like I'd, you know, washed my hands and moved on a little bit. You know, I'd kind of like, you know, she's through it now. She's done and dusted. Everybody says, you know, you've got to get through 5 years before you can consider yourself cured of cancer. And I was, I was thinking, nah, she's got it. She's good. So when the relapse happened, it just, I was floored again, but I was floored in such a different way. It was, I think the first time around it was shock. There was so much shock because it was just so out of the blue. Whereas this time, it was as if that every ounce of air had been kicked out of my body. It was like I'd just been punched in the solar plexus and I breathed out and lost everything and I couldn't breathe in. I was just completely deflated. And it's which is such a different sensation to the previous one. It was like I'd been knocked out, knocked to the floor this time, and I didn't know how I was going to get up. That's how I felt. Evie was amazing. In some ways, she faced this relapse in such an empowered way. She was just like, nah, I'm going to beat this fucker, And she, when the relapse happened, they wanted to bring her into the hospital to start treatment again straight away with the idea of going into a transplant. And she refused. She simply said, look, is it urgent? Have I got time? And they said, yeah, you've got some time. And she said, okay, I'm going to see if I can beat this myself. I'm going for the miracle. And for 3 months, she did everything that she could to do it. And I watched her transform the awakening that I saw occur in Evie was an amazing sight to behold. It was like she touched an essence or a part, a wisdom of life that, I've only ever dreamed of really touching in a way. It was like, in some ways, it's the gift of death, the gift of mortality that I witnessed in her. She saw things differently. One of the things I wrote in one of my numerous Facebook posts was I talked about how it was like she was seeing people differently. We'd walk down the street and the way she would say hello, she really saw people, and in particular the homeless and people who were on the street and begging. She would just stop and talk to them and see them in a way that was so profound to watch and incredibly moving. But that wasn't my story either. So she was having this quite empowered awakening and I just felt completely disempowered. It was like all of my, I just felt like my life had been, taken away from me. And this, I think, is the challenge as a support person. It's like, it can be quite a disempowering place to be because it feels as if life is happening to you. It felt like life was happening to me. I was just being pushed around. It was like I was just getting smashed by the waves one after the other. It was like I was stuck in the whitewash. I use a surfing analogy here, trying to paddle out. It's trying to get beyond the reef break, but I'm just stuck in the drop zone, just getting pummeled one wave after the next, after the next, after the next. And every time it feels like there's an opening that's there and I see the back of the line and I'm just trying to punch out to the back and then boom, I get smashed again. So that's just how it felt. It's just like a constant thing of smashing. And part of that too was that for me, I was, Evie was really going for the self-healing. And as it went on, I was really starting to sense that the doctors were getting nervous. They were really wanting her to start this process. That's what I was picking up. I could feel myself getting anxious because it was like, Evie, the doctors really wanted her to what I was hearing, and this is the interesting thing, right? So, you know, what I was hearing and what Evie was hearing when the doctors were speaking were two different things. You know, Evie was hearing, you know, you've got permission to take a bit of time. And I was hearing, time is up. It's time for you to come in. This was after about two and a half months, you know. And it was one memorable meeting where we both, 2 days after when we talked about it, we both completely interpreted what the doctor had said differently. And I was coming from, you know, I was coming from a place of fear. I was coming from this place of, you know, I'm scared that you're going to, that Evie was going to leave it too long before she got treatment, and that it was going to be really, really difficult for her to get back from it. And that fear was because I had no control over it. I had no control over any of it, no control over what was happening for her, no control over what was happening for me, anything. I was just caught in this place of helplessness. And whereas, you know, because of Evie, you know, whereas it was different for Evie, you know, I know that. You know, shit, she's got to go through all of that, all of the treatment and the horror show of it. But, you know, she could make decisions. And so that, you know, one of the big things I've learned through this is learning that, you know, to know what are the things that I can make decisions about and what are the things that I can't, and learning how to find some way of accepting those things that I can't make decisions, that I just have to go with, but being aware of what I can make decisions about and doing that, because it's so healthy to find something somewhere that can empower me a little bit. And that's something I'd say to anybody who's in this place of being a support person, you know, finding things that you can take control of. So for example, you know, one of the big you know, it's fair to say that in this relapse, I would say that I got quite depressed, you know, a real sense of helplessness and a real sense of deep listlessness, depression in the body. Is I mean, it's the way I can describe it. And it was this feeling of helplessness. And, you know, that I had a good 2 months where I just felt that that's where I was, that I was stuck there. And then I realized that I needed that. This was when I realized that I needed to start making some decisions about how I was looking after myself. And one of the big personal realization, you know, the big decisions I made was, you know, for me, I know that how I take care of myself, and in particular how I spend the first hour of my day, makes a huge difference to how I feel. And for me, that what that looks like is, it looks like getting up early, getting myself out of bed at a time before I would naturally just wake up, actually generate some heat by making myself get out of bed in the morning, go for a walk, get down. We're living near the beach, so go to the beach, get my feet in the sand, see the sun, see the sea, and see the sun rise as well, and catch the glimpses of that, and then come back. Now I journal, do some writing, and a bit of yoga too, yoga and or meditation, but some stuff that gets me into my body, gets me breathing, gets me moving. But also the writing was a catharsis too. It helped me get shit out of my head, push it away, free myself of it. And it just doing that shifted the energy completely. It pulled me out of the state that I was in, that depressive state that I was in, which was really driven by grief, the sadness I had of all this, all the grief I was feeling from because of all the change. But then also the depression came from the lack of control, just that helplessness, those two things. So making that morning routine really shifted things. And that's a big thing for me, was that I've learned is this idea of finding some way of gaining control, making what what decisions can I make that can help me as I'm going through this? And, you know, so that's been a huge lesson and a huge observation of what it's like as a support person, you know, that powerlessness that can come from it. So this second time around, this relapse has been a much harder journey to be on. And it's also been harder because, you know, I'm a parent, and which means that we have a daughter that has been going through this whole thing with us. You know, Maya, when this first started, she'd just turned five. She was a little five-year-old girl whose home was in Bali. That was all she knew. And so for the last 2 years of her life, you know, she's coming on now nearly seven. You know, she's had to deal with the fact that her mum has actually had this illness hanging over her head for a big portion of the last 2 years. And she's seen all the big impacts that it's had on Evie's health. You know, the most traumatic thing for a little 5, 6, 7-year-old girl is seeing her mum with no hair. You know, it didn't really dawn on me until this time round, you know, when Evie had to shave her hair off the second time. But the trauma that Maya feels when she sees her mum with no hair is huge. Like, that's the most traumatic thing. And I think it's traumatic because that's the biggest symbol that her mum's not well. And for a girl who is a little girl, she's a real girl. You know, hair and long hair is what she associates with women and girls. And so to see her mum without it is just so, so hard. But what is, but there has been a big change that has happened over the last 2 years in relation to this. And this is what I've had to deal with as a dad now in relation to going through this journey with cancer. Because as a dad, when we just started it, when Maya, as a five-year-old and a new five-year-old, just literally turned five when we got Evie's diagnosis, you know, at five, kids are still very much, from what I'm now seeing and learning, you know, they're still very much a present, they're very much present beings, right? They're not thinking about stuff so much, you know, like in the moment when you know, for that first 6 months of the first round, the first treatment that Evie went through before, in 2020, you know, through all of that, you know, if Maya would see Evie, of course, you know, she would be upset. But when Evie wasn't around, when she was in hospital or Maya was away, you know, it wasn't like she was thinking about, you know, she might say, "I miss Mama," but she wasn't really thinking about what Evie was going through and the experience that Evie was going through. But this time, you know, this time it's very different. This time, you know, it's probably summed up best when the day before Evie had her transplant, so this was only a couple of weeks ago, so the day before Evie had the transplant, I was driving Maya into the hospital because Evie was already in the hospital doing some prep. And, you know, we were taking her in because it was the last time that Evie was going to be able to see Maya for a good 4 to 5 weeks. Maya's not allowed in the hospital on the ward and because she's a kid. And in particular, the room that Evie's in right now is an isolation room. So Maya can't go in there. And, you know, I'm driving us in, I'm driving Maya in, and I look over and she's sitting in the seat next to me, and I see her head's down, and I could see the expression on her face was really sad, and I'm like, "Bubby, what's going on? And she just, in this softest but also heaviest voice I've heard her, she just says, I was just thinking about mummy. I don't want mummy to die. You know, it'd be okay if mummy dies, but I don't want her to. I was just thinking about her. And that was the first time that I've heard Maya talk about, you know, the thought process. It was like she had moved into a different stage of life where she's now actually ruminating on something, you know, thinking about what might happen and thinking forward and remembering all the stuff that's happened in the past. And all of a sudden, it was in that moment I realized, you know, this is very different for Maya now than it was 2 years ago. It's having a bigger impact on her, and it's meant that I've had to be and pay attention really, really differently. You know, there's a definitely obvious factor of her being more emotionally vulnerable now than she was, you know, through all this. You know, she's been fucking amazing. Our daughter has been amazing in this, and that she's been able to shake off all the change and roll with it and make friends and, you know, be happy and cuddly and grateful through all of this, you know. And it's only now that I'm seeing that you know, this, it is having an impact. And, you know, so trying as a dad, you know, trying to be aware of that and manage it and to know what to do is the hard. It's so hard. I often don't know what to do. I feel like, you know, I had a moment a week ago where I took Maya and I went, we were spending some time together, and we went to the shopping mall, and I just had to pop in and go grab some shoes. But I got myself sidetracked. She wanted to stay in the car, which she often does. She's often really happy in there. But I got sidetracked and I stayed in there, I don't know, it's probably 5 minutes longer than I intended to. And I came back out and she was just in tears. And because she thought that I'd abandoned her. She thought I'd left her. And it just broke my heart. I mean, it was a stupid mistake, and but it wasn't anything that I hadn't done it before, but it was just, but it's this situation where, you know, she is so much more vulnerable and prone to experiencing things in a way that she wouldn't do in the past. And so as a dad, you know, that was potentially one of the most heartbreaking things that I've ever had to experience, seeing her, and fuck, I'm crying. It's you know, that to feel that in my daughter, you know, that sense of you know, that she's having to go through, this. I mean, I know that she's not the only 7-year-old in the world who's ever had to go through a parent being sick. And I also know that, you know, kids have go through a lot worse than this. But, you know, she's my daughter. She's my daughter and I love her. And, you know, as a dad, I want to protect this little girl, and there are some and yet she's going through an unfathomable thing for a little 6-7-year-old girl to have to go through, which is, you know, being separated from her mum, who is really, really sick. And, you know, and it has my heart bleed for every other child out there who's having to go through the same thing, and every parent who's having to go through the same thing in relation to maybe having a sick child. You know, it's It's just such a difficult situation. And, you know, and I realized that there are two things that she needs from me. One, she needs me to be there. She needs me to be around. And two, she needs play. She needs cuddles and she needs play. She needs interaction. She needs my presence. She actually needs my presence, and I'm not, it's not a physical presence, it's an emotional presence. And she just wants to be a, you know, she just wants to be a kid and a girl, and that's the best thing that I can give her. What I've come to realize is as much of that as possible, you know. And and the gift that I get from that is that it keeps me tapped into my emotional self, my sense of, you know, one of the things that's easy to happen in this situation is it's almost to get a little bit numb to it over time. It's like there's so much pain and grief that it's easy to, it's like familiarity, right? So it's not a numbness, it's just a familiarity of it all, you know, that, you know, day in and day out, there's this intense situation and it just breeds familiarity. I'm sure, you know, it's happened, it's how we get through traumatic events, you know. I'm sure throughout all of history, people would say the same thing. It's like it begins to get normal, right? These quite intense traumatic situations just become normal, and it's like the center line for it all just balances out. You just kind of find an equilibrium in it, and that's what I have. But what Maya does is she keeps me tapped into my emotional, into what's really going on emotionally. She doesn't let me get numb, and I'm grateful for that. I don't want to be numb in this. So she does that, and that's the beauty of children. So it's a tough road being a dad and a husband in this journey. And you know, at this moment, I know that Evie is going to get through this. You know, she's going to get through this and out the other side. And I'm so curious to know what it's going to be like for her on the other side of this. It's another reason for doing this episode early, talking about this early, because you know what is. I'm curious. I don't know what is on the other side of this. And I'm curious to know what is, what will be there. What would it be like for her? What will it be like for me? Because I know that, you know, that this is it for her treatment insofar as, you know, she ain't going to go back and do any more chemotherapy. You know, this works or it doesn't, and we move forward. I'm confident it's going to work. And I just want to speak actually just about the transplant, just to, like to, how amazing the transplant is. So what's happened is the transplant that Evie's received, the stem cells that Evie has received are her mum, from her mum. So her mum, so which means that she's a 50% genetic match with her mum. Right. They try to, you know, the closer they can get to 100, the better. And random strangers can be a genetic match when it comes to stem cells. But they have a stem cell registry worldwide with 10 million people on it. But just to show how hard it is to get a match, there wasn't a match for Evie. So her mum was her one and only chance. So, I mean, think about that for a moment, right? Her mum is giving life to her daughter for a second time. I mean, what a gift. It's amazing, really. And I mean, heartbreaking for Evie's mum too, to have to witness this and to go through it. So Evie's mum, the way the stem cells come out is she's essentially on a bed, and they've got one IV line coming out of one arm, and it comes out and it goes through a centrifugal machine like they do when they get in plasma, and then they send it back into the other arm. So she essentially spent 6 hours a day for 2 days getting all of her blood extracted, and they would spin it and pull the stem cells and then feed it back in, just doing that and circling the blood. I think they go through the blood, the entire blood supply, 3 or 4 times in her mum's body each day, to come out to get enough stem cells for the transplant. But so the interesting thing is that because Evie's mum was only 50% match, when they did the transplant, what happens is that the stem cells go in, and it's essentially just a blood transfusion. That's all it looks like. But the moment they go in, because of that 50% match, and because it's impossible to get rid of every T cell, which are the cells, the immune cells that go around and kind of look for the baddies and they attack the baddies. So in the stem cells that they got from Evie's mum, it's impossible to get rid of all the T cells. So when they did the transplant, instantly there was a reaction inside Evie's body, because the T cells that from her mum came in and started attacking Evie. They just started attacking, and which is part of the course. So, you know, after they'd finished they were going to do four bags of stem cells. They ended up doing 3, because after they finished the third one, Evie broke out into a fever, and essentially it was like her whole body was kind of going into a bit of shock, really. It was the new cells were fighting the old cells, and I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. But you know, so what they end up doing is a couple of days after the transplant, they give Evie some more chemotherapy, weirdly enough, to actually wipe out the T cells that have arrived from her mum, so that her body has got absolutely no immune system whatsoever, so that the new stem cells can begin to start replicating and grow in Evie's body, so that it can begin to then take over and populate Evie and essentially change her genetic code. So she is now, as we speak, developing a whole new genetic code. Her blood type is even changing. I think she's O positive and going to A positive. I'm not sure. I can't remember which ones it was, but I probably got those letters wrong. But she's changing. Her blood type is changing. Sometime after about 2 weeks from the transplant, they have to give, when they start to give Evie blood transfusions, which they do all the time, they have to give her a different blood type. It's just mind-blowing. So again, you know, Western medicine, it blows me away sometimes what they're able to do. But so, you know, that's the gift of life that Evie's mum has given her, which is amazing. But so, you know, how all this is going to play out is just such a mystery, and that's the question I'm living in right now. And it's a wild question to live in. It's almost an unfathomable question to live in to a degree. But this has been quite a long tale, and I've jumped around a little bit. I've just kind of told it as it's come to my head and reflected, and if I'm honest, I probably could spend another hour or two going into much finer details about the whole thing and the process and what we went through. But there's a couple of things that, you know, for me, that I just wanted to share a couple of important things that I've got from this as a support person. And you know, one of the big things that I mentioned before was a sense of having a you know, creating that morning routine. I think for me, and finding some way of getting some kind of control, some decisions, making some decisions, it was the single most important thing for me to help me shift from this state of helplessness and a victim. You know, I was in a victim stage as well, mate. That's the truth. I was feeling like a victim with a whole bunch of stuff happening to me. So, you know, doing that was really important. When it comes to help, you know, as a support person, right, I'm constantly giving out help, and it's hard. As a man, I consider myself a guy who's good at communicating and reaching out, but even in this instance, it is so hard to actually put my hand up and go, I need help, because I feel like my role is as a support person. That's what I'm here to do. And, you know, it's hard to then get help for myself. And what I've noticed is a lot of people will say, you know, and it's with the best of intentions, hey, mate, I'm here. If you need anything, reach out. But it ain't that easy. And what I've learned is the thing that has saved me is not me reaching out, it's people reaching out to me. Is when somebody, a friend that I know or care about, just actually picks up the phone and goes, hey, how are you doing? What's going on? And that has been a lifesaver. And I've had two or three people who, and Rich, my mate Richie, he's been one of them, who, you know, we've just had it in the diary every week. Boom, rain, hail, sleet or snow, tired, fucked off, incommunicative, whatever, we speak. And that has saved my life on numerous occasions, you know. And I say that sounds dramatic, saved my life, but I mean it. It's like it stopped me from spiraling and going into this really horrible place. Drinking. I have to say I've drunk my way through some of it at times. And, you know, I'm not going to say don't drink because, you know, whatever. Sometimes it's what works, but I have to say being clear-headed does make all the difference. And, you know, trying to be aware of that has actually made a huge difference to me, as does sleep, because the other thing that happens with drinking is it interferes with sleep. And probably sleep is more important than exercise, which is also very important. It's so, so important. You know, being able to get sleep that's the healing thing. Getting a good 8 hours, fucking so nourishing, so important. But here's possibly the thing that I've found to be, well, it's not the most important, but here's on a more macro scale, here's the super big lesson I've got. It's like what I did is I worked out what are the two or three single most important things that I need to focus on, and I've let everything else go. So in this instance, you know, right now it's like Evie is the looking after Evie. So which means going to the hospital every day, taking a food, doing, you know, spending essentially 6 to 8 hours a day kind of focusing on Evie and what she needs. And her mum is here with me, so we'll go into the hospital together and we'll tag team and we'll do stuff. But, you know, so that's one, Evie. Two is Maya, looking after Maya and her needs. And which sometimes actually means putting Maya first over Evie, because, you know, Evie is supportive of her mum, Maya needs her dad. And so for me, you know, Evie and Maya, they're not lumped together, they're separate entities, taking care of each one of them and their needs. I've kind of made a priority. And then for me, the third thing has been this morning routine that I do, and exercise. So I've kind of lumped them, they're kind of a thing. It's like the self-care. That's the big self-care thing that I've been doing. And everything else takes a back seat. So I've got this project, the Man Reimagined project, you know, I'm doing it, but it takes a back seat if I need to those other three things. I've got some work that I'm, the Anxiety Unloaded, which I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago. You know, that's really important to me, but it takes a back seat to those other things. If Maya needs something from me, that gets the priority over that, over the work. I've got friends and things like that. And while friends nourish me and they do everything, you know, they take a back seat if I'm needed in these other two things, particularly with Evie and Maya, you know. Friends will sometimes I'll put over my exercise and my morning routine because they nourish, it's nourishing. So it's this kind of thing around self-nourishing. But essentially, everything else comes first. And it's meant that there's a bit of financial hardship because, you know, we're not looking, you know, work has taken a back seat. But, you know, really, this is what I've worked out I need to do in order to get through this. And it is about getting through this and getting to the other side and getting through it in a sane, healthy way. And that's my goal. And now I think I'm doing okay. It's a journey, but I think I'm doing okay. And you know, that, I mean, they're simple things to share. They might sound obvious as you're listening to them, but you know, it's taken me a while to figure that out. It's taken me a while to kind of get a handle on this. And you know, it's still a day-to-day battle in many ways, trying to stay on top of how I'm feeling. And if I let this stuff slip, if I don't sleep well, if I drink, if I forget my morning routines, I just need to do that for two or three days on the trot and I'll slide and I'll slip. So staying on top of those things it's almost religious, right? That's what I need to do to take care of myself. And when I take care of those things, everything else is going okay. So this is the journey. It's a big journey that I've been on, and my journey pales in comparison to the one that Evie's been on. And one day I'm hoping that she'll come on and share whatever wisdom she's taken from her path. But I hope that this podcast, this story, my experience has, I don't know, shown a little bit about what it's like to be inside of a cancer, the cancer journey, the cancer story, I guess. Inside it as a husband, as a father, as a person supporting their dearest to go through this. You know, I know one day I'm probably going to look back and there's going to be so many gifts that I've got from it. Right now, I'm trying to learn the gifts as I can go and integrate them as much as possible while still staying afloat and not drowning. And, you know, it is a matter of one foot after the other and learning as I go. So I hope you've made it through. If anybody who's got through to the end of this little story, I appreciate you. You're taking the time to listen, to be here till the end. I've done this as much for myself as for anybody else, just to put this down and to speak to it. But if you've got any gold, you know, I'd love to, you know, anything you want to share with me, please do. I'd love to hear from you. This has been an emotional story to tell. And as I said, if you've got through it, I really appreciate you taking the time to get to the end. So for now, I'm just going to say goodnight, goodbye. Lots of love to whoever's heard this. And I'm sending you all of my heartfelt wishes. And if anybody else is going through the same journey, I wish you all the best. Please feel free to reach out to me too, because I'm here to share this journey and to support other people as they go through it. So for now, this is Malcolm signing off another episode of Man Reimagined. And until next time, when I'm sure Rich will be back and sharing another tale. But for now, good night and good gardening to you all. From this week's podcast, if there's been anything that's inspired you, challenged you, or simply left you wanting more, then please reach out to Richie and Mal via their Facebook page, Man Reimagined. Just like you, we're trying to get a handle on all these issues and topics, so the more we're able to share and talk about them, I think the better off we're all going to be. Until next time, catch you later.